I had the pleasure this week of reading a new book. It came out in 2011, and this is from Peter David Shapiro. Mr. Shapiro was born in Montreal, Canada. I knew that I was going to already like him for that. And now lives in the Boston area. He's written three books, and I had the good fortune this week of reading Ghosts on the Red Line. And I can't give commercial-type accolades to products because we're a nonprofit radio station, but when I saw the layout of the book, the size of it, the number of pages, and I looked at the cover price, I thought this is one of the best buys that I've made or anybody could make for a long time. Peter joins us, I believe, from the greater Boston area, and I really enjoyed, Peter, your book.
Well, thank you very much.
Was that a project for you that took months or years to complete? Tell us about the writing of the book, Ghosts on the Red Line.
It took about a year. I first had the inspiration. I was doing a morning walk, which I do every morning, which I did for 14 years with our dog, and then the dog left us, and so I just kept taking the walk even though she wasn't with me, and I was in the midst of the walk, and the title came to me first. It just popped in my head, Ghosts on the Red Line, and I was thinking, geez, I wonder what would happen if people saw or encountered their departed on the Red Line, which is a major subway line in Boston. And that's where the book came from. I started filling in the what ifs of from the title. And it took about a year from that time to complete it and get it out. I'd been working on another book for about 5 years, which wasn't really ready for prime time, so I put it aside and turned to this one. And it felt much better, and it moved much more quickly than the first one, obviously.
I think the listeners are going to enjoy a conversation today because although your book is a novel with the story being made up, in a way, you're using elements that are from our society right now as well as perhaps part of our future. Some of the new discoveries, new technologies, understandings of how we work as human beings, the nature of consciousness. You bring a lot of questions into this book, don't you?
Yeah, that was the challenge. I mean, I come from a position of being a skeptic, actually, on ghosts. And so my challenge in writing the book was to think, how could this happen where these visitations would occur and we wouldn't really know for sure whether, you know, what they were, whether they were actual visitations from the departed of the people who were being visited or something else. But how could it happen that it would happen on Red Line subway train? And so that's where it turns out that the Red Line runs past MIT, which is a major technology oriented university in Cambridge, and I was thinking of one of the things which happens in Cambridge sometimes when the lights dim or something else goes on, something's going on at MIT. So
that's right.
So that's where the notion came from. Something is happening at MIT, which is causing these visitations to occur on the Red Line, which happens to run right by MIT. And that's how the story. But then I was thinking, okay, what could be happening in MIT that could cause these things to occur? And and there are some technologies in there which I made up, and there's some technologies which are actually real.
Mm-hmm. They are able to take perhaps at times people and testing environments and hook them up to sensors and measuring devices, and then try to give portions of the brain stimulus to see if they can initiate a mystical or paranormal experience. And researchers have found that they can actually do that by triggering parts of the brain with minute charges of electricity, that they can more or less create something very similar to what people report as a mystical and or a paranormal experience. So you're a skeptic, but I would think that you're an open-minded skeptic.
Yeah, I'd say I'm certainly interested in the possibility of these things happening.
Because I think really, you know, if we had to, my take would be, Peter, is that if we had to really give a definition of a skeptic, I think you've got to be open-minded to be a skeptic, don't you?
You have to be, right, you have to be open to possibilities that of things happening, and also skeptical of the easy explanation.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking, okay, what else might be the reason for something that folks are reporting? So it's an empirical orientation. What could be the explanations of the things that we hear about that make sense and that can be supported by evidence?
Did you perhaps, Peter, growing up as a young man, and or more recently in contemporary times as an adult, have you ever had an experience that you yourself would categorize as quote-unquote extraordinary?
I don't know if I have. I don't think so. I've had experiences that I thought were extraordinary and turned out to be not, and that was interesting. I mean, I had a friend in college who disappeared down in Tennessee for some time, and the thought was that he'd committed suicide or his body had been lost or whatever, and he was gone for quite a long time, and I thought, you know, I had the sense that at least I dreamed about him and wondered what had happened to him and so on, and I just assumed that he was gone. And then a few years later, eating in a restaurant in Cambridge, I saw him, actually. And he was really there. He was in true life. He was a waiter in the restaurant. And it had turned out that he had disappeared. He disappeared on purpose. He wanted to change his life. So he'd crashed his car, and he found ways to just disappear for a number of years and surface back in Cambridge. So I guess I might have had thoughts that were extraordinary and turned out to be not the case, but I don't know. I mean, sometimes when you ride in on the Red Line or other public transit systems, who knows what you're seeing, but I can't say that I have.
We have many years ago, a gentleman that worked for a Omaha, Nebraska TV station, Fritz the Weatherman, and he worked there for a number of years until somebody traveling through recognized his picture as being somebody who'd lived on the West Coast, and apparently he'd had some sort of an accident and had full amnesia about his prior life, and so reinvented himself as a weatherman and did so ably for many years, all the while with a new family here in the Midwest and his original family on the West Coast. Well, it's an interesting subject because you can approach the paranormal from a number of different vantage points. I like to tell people that my own sense, Peter, is that when somebody has their own extraordinary experience and they go through the prosaic, natural explanations and give healthy consideration to those, if those don't satisfy or fully explain the experience, and they're left with a big question mark, it gets very, very interesting. Did you, during the research for the book, did you talk to people who had reported seeing or experiencing ghosts?
I read about them. I've read a number of books, obviously, and stories of people who saw ghosts or believe or reported that they saw ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in many cases these stories are. These occurrences happen in enclosed environments, like in houses, or where somebody's alone, or there's only one or two other people with them, and they think they see something, or they report that they've seen something, which is either ephemeral, or it actually looks like a person, or somebody that they knew, I wanted to do something, you know, I could have, I think, developed a story like that, but I wanted to do something a bit different, which I haven't read about, which is where this kind of visitation occurs in a public environment.
Mm-hmm.
with a lot of people around, and it's something which is witnessed by a lot of people. In this story, in Ghosts on the Red Line, nobody else on the Red Line train sees what the person being visited sees, but they can tell something's happening because the person who's being visited is very upset, or is discussing or talking or having some kind of interaction with something which is invisible to everybody else. So that's how this story is, I think, different than the reports that you generally read of people who see ghosts.
And I found that intriguing because it set my mind thinking that typically the stories that I've heard, as you just alluded to some of them, there is an apparition.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most popular ways that people experience a ghost is by, of course, sight or perception. There are other ways that we can talk about, too, of experiencing a ghost, but seeing an apparition is a classic. And, if one person in the group sees the apparition, they all do. But in your book, Ghosts on the Red Line, it's a very personal experience.
Right.
The people themselves on this subway car, they're being exposed to the same electromagnetic energy, the same environment, the same stimuluses, the sounds, the smells, the slight movement, and yet there is one person that has the experience. They are interacting and seeing something that nobody else in the car can.
Right.
And so I tried to think about that, and I wondered, was that because maybe there was some sort of a line in queue of spirits and souls on the other side who were waiting patiently, and there was only one admitted at a time? If the guy was having an experience with his departed brother, and he was seeing the brother, touching, interacting, physical contact, etc., conversation, why do you suppose other people couldn't see that?
I think the answer is they couldn't see that in that particular interaction. I think in terms of the cue, I might have written, and it might have been possible in this story, for more than one person in one of the cars of the Red Line. The Red Line's pretty long; it can have 10 or 20 cars on it.
Right.
But there could be multiple people having these experiences at once. The limitations of writing a book, which already was 300 pages, were such that I described one at a time. If it were the case that multiple people on the train car could see the same apparition, mm-hmm. the same visitation,
mm-hmm.
then that would tilt the scale towards this really is a ghost happening here. I wanted to leave it still a possibility that what they're having is imagination or hallucination.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is one of the theories which is brought forward by one of the MIT professors who's involved in this process. He points out, as you mentioned earlier, that with certain kinds of stimulation in the brain, there's a euphoria which can occur, and you could have hallucinations and so on. And so I wanted to leave that possibility open, that what was happening in these train cars was that people were being stimulated by the electromagnetic energy, and some of them, in some cases, they're departed. The result was that they were seeing departed or seeing people they didn't want to see. And in the cases of the gangster, notorious gangster based in Somerville's town down here, that he did not want to see the visitation that he saw, because that was one of the people that his people had murdered, and it was very unpleasant for him.
Yeah, the gangster that comes into play in the book, and we're not going to try to give away the major plot lines and some of the things that happen, but the gangster that comes into play, he's really concerned about the experience of people being able to contact individuals on the other side, and or having them contact the people living, for fear of all the people that he's put in the ground coming forward and saying, yeah, this bad guy, he was the culprit.
Exactly. He's not so much worried about the police, because he's managed to deal with police over the years. He's more worried about family members of his victims,
mm-hmm.
getting kind of definitive proof, in a sense, from their relatives or their friends who surfaced on the Red Line trains and say, you know, his name is Michael Wallace, nicknamed Shiny Mikey. Shiny Mikey did this to me. And that would cause him problems. But he's quite concerned about this.
Is there an individual in real life in the Boston area that resembles Shiny Mikey? And if you get in too much trouble, you can just say yes and not be more specific.
Well, there's no single person, but Somerville, there have been gangsters. There's a gangster, a gang named, I think, the Winterhill Gang, which I think were based in Somerville.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been gangsters based in Somerville. And so he's a composite of various kinds of gangsters that we've had here over the years. We just finally got one in jail, Whitey Bulger. I don't know if you heard the Whitey Bulger story, but a Boston gangster who's been on the run for decades, and they finally caught him and finally imprisoned him, 18 murders, something like that.
I've always enjoyed the Robert Parker Spencer books.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're set in the Boston, the greater Boston area.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of landmarks are worked into to Parker's books.
Yeah.
This is Peter David Shapiro, and he's our guest this morning on Exploring Unexplained Phenomena, the author of three books. This book that we're talking about today is called Ghosts on the Red Line. And his website is easy to find. It's his first name, Peter, the letter D, and last name Shapiro, shapiro.com. Peter, D as in David, Shapiro.com. One of the things, again, just to perhaps close up that earlier part of our conversation about the single individual in a car filled with people having the very personal experience, It intrigued me because I have this sense from decades of research and some personal experience that indeed the extraordinary experience can and often is a very personal experience. And there is a relationship there between the witness, the person experiencing the phenomena, the methodology of the conduit of how it takes place, and the perception of what they're seeing or hearing or feeling or tasting or smelling that seems to be very personal. I'm reminded, Peter, of some of the stories, for example, of a ballpark that there are thousands of people watching a baseball game, and one person looks up and sees the UFO hovering overhead. You would think that with thousands of people in the stands, there'd be more than one witness.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's very, very personal. You know, right time, right place, right line of sight. I saw a UFO. Wasn't my first, the night of the summer solstice, looking out at the southern horizon in Lincoln, Nebraska. And I couldn't explain it prosaically, naturally. I submitted a report to the Mutual UFO Network. And I've gone down a number of avenues trying to find resolution with what I did see. There was one other person I talked to that night who apparently was also outside at the same time, saw something similar.
I would think if you have multiple people seeing it, that's certainly more evidence that mm-hmm. there really was something there versus one person seeing it. So that's what I was sort of trying to figure out how to describe also in the story, But yeah, so you had more than one person seeing the UFO in this stadium.
Yes,
somebody else.
Yes, we have a pretty active Facebook page, and after I'd had that sighting that night on June 21st, I posted on Facebook that I'd just seen something anomalous and described what it was. And a friend of mine immediately popped on and said that he happened to be, roughly several miles away from my location and had seen something very similar also looking out that night. Professor Harley Rutledge taught at a college in Missouri back in the 60s and 70s, and during one or more big reports or flaps, periods of intense activity and increase in sightings, he thought, if people are seeing things, let's organize a systematic sort of Operation Skywatch, and we'll have volunteers go out and record what they see, and then we'll attempt to prosaically, naturally explain a number of things that we can. Is it transatlantic aircraft? Is it weather phenomena, etc.? And in spite of their best efforts, they had a very significant number of unknowns that they were able to naturally, prosaically explain. Peter, when we come back from our break, could you talk about, and perhaps how you wove this into the book, why are people interested in ghosts?
I'll take a crack at it, yeah. Sure.
Peter David Shapiro, his website, Peter, the letter D, Shapiro, Shapiro.com. Our special guest, the author of Ghosts on the Red Line. And Matt, this will be a book, I think, that as a novel, I think you're going to enjoy this.
Cool.
What was that?
Very cool.
There you go. I had your mic down. Sorry. Guys and gals, stay right there. Scott Colborne, Matt Mundorf, and Peter David Shapiro. We'll be right back.
Voice of the Blues in Lincoln, Nebraska, KZUM Lincoln and KZUM HD.
The full moon lights the silver rails winding around dark mountains and over steep gorges of jagged rock and one freezing cold rushing black mountain river. I wish there was enough time to describe all of the funny twists and turns that led up to now, but there isn't enough time because there's a ticking clock and the two passengers we care most about don't know anything about it. To see what happens next, visit read.gov to read The Exquisite Corpse, a riveting adventure pieced together by John Cheska, Shannon Hale, Daniel Handler, and other popular authors. Explore new worlds. Read. Brought to you by the Library of Congress and the Ad Council.
Hi, John Chuck here to tell you that Religion for Life has gone to the birds. You knew that already. My guest is Debbie Blue, author of Consider the Birds, a provocative guide to birds of the Bible. She shows us how looking at birds of the Bible can lead us to social and ecological justice. Join us on Religion for Life, Saturday afternoon at 1 on 89.3 KZUM.
Season of NET Television's Coffee and Conversation film and discussion series continues at 1 p.m. on Sunday, November 17th, with a screening of The State of Arizona at the Mary Ritma Ross Media Arts Center, 313 North 13th Street. The documentary examines Arizona's battle over illegal immigration, tracked from the perspectives of activists, politicians, immigrants, controversial Sheriff Joe Arpaio, and others. A moderated discussion led by local experts will follow the film. This season of Coffee and Conversation, continuing on November 17th, is presented in partnership with ITVS Community Cinema, Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, the Malone Community Center, The Ross, and your community radio station, KZUM. More information is available at netnebraska.org/engage.
Our guest this morning, Peter David Shapiro, and the book, Ghosts on the Red Line. Peter, why are people interested in ghosts? And second question, is that interest historical in terms of being very, very much the same? Or has our interest, as the years have gone by, has it shifted?
I think the answer, the best I can say it, is that why people are interested in ghosts is that it deals with death. And we all have this fundamental mystery facing us about dying, and we all die. And we know that. Don't like the thought of it, but we all do. We've had this knowledge. I think this is what distinguishes humans from other creatures, that we have the knowledge of it. So it's a fundamental mystery, and that mystery is the basis of basically all religions, as far as I know. What they have, religions have different ways of getting at it. People have also had, everyone has losses, people they've loved who passed on. And so the real question is, accepting the finality of dying or death, both the finality of other people dying who you love and miss, and of your own death coming along. So ghosts are a, it's a way of responding to that, and people are interested in ghosts because if there's any evidence of ghosts, what that means is that death isn't as final as everybody assumes, that there's something that lives on in the spiritual form or spirit form or some other form. So I think that's really, it's the core of it. It's the core of religions, and it all centers on kind of this notion, this knowledge that we have that everybody dies. I don't know whether it's changed over the years. I guess I think the core of religions probably hasn't changed all that much over the millennia. I think goes back to the same core. Whether the visitations by ghosts, that is, I think every culture probably has different ways of describing it. I think these things probably occur in every culture, but they may be described in different ways. So I think that's why I think folks are interested in it. Certainly, if there's any evidence of it, that's a strong interest to people because everybody's faced with the same end result.
I know in the book that there's certainly the very personal human aspect that there are relationships that with the death and passing of someone appear to be severed or significantly impacted. And if there is a way that people could bridge that gap and communicate with their loved ones, the vehicle that opens up in the book, of course, is yes, they can do that. There's a, through the quirk and happenstance on the red line, there's a process, a technology found that enables people to apparently do that. And for several of the characters in the book, there's enough evidence that happens that they're satisfied that it's not just simply a tweaking of the brain with an electrical signal and just funny things happen. There's some real specific things that happened to indicate that there's that very deep and personal relationship.
They certainly believe it's real, and I think that's how the story gets started, really, that the main protagonist is actually a consultant, as I've been a consultant for many years, named Harry West, and his ex-wife, Alexandra, has a visitation from their daughter, who was killed by a drunk driver when she was only 3 years old, and she appears to his ex-wife as a teenager, and the story describes how that could be. But this is a very important experience to his ex-wife, who is a very sophisticated entrepreneurial person in Boston, very intelligent person, not given to hallucinations as far as she's concerned, and she believes it's real, and it's very important to her, and it's important to other people to whom it happens as well. So. These are at least described in the book, very, very strong personal experiences. And as the word gets out that folks are having these experiences, of course, other people who have had losses, who would like to have visitations from their loved ones, start to crowd onto the red line as well, hoping that'll happen to them. And that's part of the dynamism of the story is dynamics of the story is what would happen in the city of Boston if the word got out that folks were having these visitations on the major subway line that crosses through the city. What would happen? And that, the way I imagine it, what would happen would be that huge crowds would start to emerge, start to come onto the trains, hoping that they'd have visitation, and they, you know, be carrying pictures and looking around and hoping very hard. And some do, and most don't. And of course, this causes chaos, and that brings a reaction from the folks that have to run the system, and then the politicians, and then the church, and everybody else is drawn in.
Yeah, there's just a simple. For some people, it might be entertainment. For the price of a subway ticket, you could ride on the red line and potentially either personally experience and or witness something taking place that would be, you know, phenomenal.
Right. Phenomenal. And I think that's a good use of the word. It is phenomenal. And for many people, it's a wonderful experience. For some people, it's a terrible experience. Mm-hmm. They're visited by folks who accuse them of things, and we have one case where someone actually goes nuts and pulls the emergency lever on the train. The doors open, and he jumps out and he's killed. So when he jumps out, and that of course causes more pressure on the transit operator called the MBTA in Boston to get this fixed, and that's why they to stop it, mm-hmm. and so they. They hired this consultant, Harry West, to figure out what's going on. And sort of like your description of the university professor who got folks to try to report what they saw of the UFOs and then to come up with explanations. What Harry West does is he has a consulting team who ride on the red line trains and report what they see, what they witness, and ask questions when they see someone having some sort of experience. And they gradually narrow it down to where these things are happening, and then they figure out, with the help of MIT, why these things are happening.
So, aside from the entertainment aspect, there is also, as you've alluded to, there's that personal connection that maybe if I were to ride on the red line, I also might have an experience with a departed loved one, a departed friend, a departed family member.
Right.
And for a lot of people, that would be a huge draw. For some people, it might be pretty scary because it calls up into question a number of different beliefs and tenets.
Yes.
And in fact, it is scary to at least one organized religion who is portrayed as being very much against this. And one can speculate, Peter, you know, as to the why.
I did a small amount. I'm not an expert on these things, but I did a small amount of research, and I believe there are theological reasons in the case of this religion why this is considered to be essentially sinful to go out and try to find spirits on your own, that you're supposed to work through the church to, you know, to have experience thinking about your loved ones and contemplating your old death and so on. So when folks were crowding onto the train, seeking out these spiritual visitations or these visits from spirits, the church was upset about that and considered it really the wrong way to behave. And they had sermons, issued against it, and then they had some political influence, and they had political, the state politicians getting organized to do something about it, which is why, again, more pressure on the MBTA to stop it. And of course, when the MBTA does finally figure out, with the help of the consultant, what's causing these visitations, the first thing they want to do is stop, to have whatever is, you know, what's happening stopped and have the visitation stopped. And this, in turn, upsets a lot of people because they want to have visitations with their loved ones, and particularly upsets Harry West's ex-wife. And so that's where the second half of the book comes along. And they, she comes up with the idea. She's an entrepreneur. Why don't we replicate? Why don't we create a space which has the same attributes as the Red Line train, so that the visitations can keep happening in our space? And that's what they set out doing. And they developed a space which they called Visitation Room.
Yeah, they have a self-interest as a motivator to do this.
Right.
They recognize that it will be tremendously received, that if they can come up with a startup capital and get it launched, that their future looks especially bright and rosy. People yeah. will just be knocking the doors down to have an experience like this, but they also have that personal motivation.
Right.
So you've got the church then involved, and they're against this. I had maybe a year ago the author Mark Hudeman on the show, who's written a book called Seeing Ghosts Through God's Eyes. And he's a retired minister. Mark makes an argument that virtually all the paranormal is demonic and is basically a masquerade or an illusion from the dark forces. And that could be one of the reasons why, in terms of that more fundamentalist approach, why the church would say stay away from contact with ghosts or spirits.
I think that's exactly right. That's actually, in doing the research I did, that is really the basis of the opposition that the church had. Was they consider this to be kind of a temptation from the dark side or from the devil, or this is evil stuff coming up, and people should not seek it out because they will get sucked in by the dark side. So that's why they're saying this is the wrong thing to do, and they tried to get it stopped. And of course, when the visitation rooms get made public, that they're going to be opening up visitation rooms in Boston, the church is particularly upset about that. They just finally got the Red Line to start to turn off this phenomenon, and now they find out that the visitation rooms are going to open up and keep it going. And so they move into higher gear to get that stopped.
Mm-hmm. The more fundamentalist reaction is a dichotomy and a paradox, because the birthplace of Jesus is described in the Bible as being initially pinpointed by three wise men. And when you do more research on what those wise men were, I understand that they were astrologers. And so, in one sense, the church says, don't consort with these sorts of things. And yet, the very thing they're trying to say don't look at was the identifier for where Jesus was going to be born. You know, I've talked with other fellow Christians about this, and I think Mark has got some validity in his claims. Because I think there is, in some aspects of the paranormal, a masquerade or an illusion taking place. But I don't think that makes the paranormal any different from anything else. I think that in all of humanity, you have people that are that are really good, that work towards the betterment of others, that are uplifting, that do a good job, stay in reasonable balance, pay their taxes, raise children. Then you have people that are folks that you'd never want to have over to your house. Mm-hmm. But because of the bad eggs, you wouldn't typify and write off all of humanity. And right. So that's the limitation I've got. I think that he's partially onto something, but I think the brush maybe is a little bit too big. But it's certainly an aspect that rises, as it should, in your book, that these visitation rooms will offer people a chance to theoretically talk with or interact very personally with a departed loved one. And it may also be fearful to the church because it may take away some of that sort of organization that they feel is necessary. It shifts the focus away from them, maybe.
And that's another part of the motivation of the church. Has multiple parts, and that's another part, that it is competitive. If people...
Thank you. That's a good descriptor. I was looking for that. That's a good way to describe that. Yes, very competitive.
Right. So what obviously what happens there is the politicians are brought in who have relationships with the church, and they start to see what they can do to stop the visitation room. And so there's a whole other little story which happens there. And, it's kind of a Massachusetts story. I don't know if you have this in Nebraska, but we've had a history here of church and politics and so on.
And that's politics. You bring that into play also, because there are forces that want to stop the visitation room. And so one of the methodologies that they employ is they find, I hope you'll forgive me here, Peter, they find a sleazy politician that they can try to manipulate to put a stop to the concept of the visitation rooms.
Right.
And, you know, as just an aside here, with some politicians, Peter, I shake my head and I just wonder, God, is there real hope for humanity when we collectively keep electing these people?
Yeah.
Jiminy Christmas.
That's right. Yeah, I agree.
We just had the debacle in Congress with teetering on the brink of default, and the House and Senate not working together, and parties conspiring against the president, etc. And you think to yourself, there are voters out there that voted these people in.
That's right. Yeah, that's the amazing thing, that some of these folks, when they say really incredibly stupid things to the newspapers and television and so on, you wonder who could possibly vote for them. I mean, how could they possibly? But I guess the districts have been structured and gerrymandered in such a way that they have their constituents. And being a democracy, we have to live with them somehow.
And find creative ways to work around.
Right.
When we come back from the bottom of the hour break, the woman who is brought in, who is a self-proclaimed psychic.
Right.
Maybe tell us a little bit about her, about her character, and maybe some of your research that you did in back of this character here.
Okay.
Our guest is Peter David Shapiro, Ghosts on the Red Line. Matt Mundorf is sitting over here on my left. I'm Scott Colborne. The coffee is tasting great. I hope you're enjoying the conversation with Mr. Shapiro. And there's going to be more. Stay tuned. Right after you hear this, you'll hear more good conversation.
Season of NET Television's Coffee and Conversation Film and Discussion Series continues at 1 p.m. on Sunday, November 17th, with a screening of The State of Arizona at the Mary Ritma Ross Media Arts Center, 313 North 13th Street. The documentary examines Arizona's battle over illegal immigration, tracked from the perspectives of activists, politicians, immigrants, controversial Sheriff Joe Arpaio, and others. A moderated discussion led by local experts will follow the film. This season of Coffee and Conversation, continuing on November 17th, is presented in partnership with ITVS Community Cinema, Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, the Malone Community Center, The Ross, and your community radio station, KZUM. More information is available at netnebraska.org/engage.
Voice of the Blues in Lincoln, Nebraska, KZUM Lincoln and KZUM HD.
Support for programming comes from Exceptional Artists and the Bourbon Theater in downtown Lincoln, presenting an evening of solo instrumental music with ukulele star Jake Shimabukuro. Known for a PBS documentary, TV appearances, and millions of YouTube views, he'll appear in concert on Monday, November 11th. Tickets are available through bourbontheater.com.
My name is Manny Morales. I'm 45 and I coach youth football. It's still hard to believe because the high school me
was a work in progress. But big brothers, big sisters give me a real role model. And the young me
need a role model bad. My bigger brother's name is Ray. And Ray is the reason that this 7-year-old grows up to be a role model himself.
Whether you donate money or time, you're helping big brothers, big sisters help a child. Start something today at bigbrothersbigsisters.org. Brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
Hi, John Chuck here to tell you that Religion for Life has gone to the birds. You knew that already. My guest is Debbie Blue, author of Consider the Birds, a provocative guide to birds of the Bible. She shows us how looking at birds of the Bible can lead us to social and ecological justice. Join us on Religion for Life, Saturday afternoon at 1 on 89.3 KZUM.
When you see a ghost, who do you call? And so, Peter David Shapiro, he's written a book called Ghosts on the Red Line. Maybe they don't necessarily call this individual, but somehow she finds out about it. And so they connect with, and into the storyline comes this self-professed psychic. Tell us a little bit about this character.
Well, Dr. Frances Gormelon is a very colorful person. She wears gemstones in every finger, and she is a large woman. She wears maxi dresses and those sorts of things. But she turns up in Harry West, the consultant's office, while they're investigating what's happening on the Red Line, and she declares that she's been sent by the MBTA, the Transit Authority, to talk to him. And it turns out that's a little bit of a white lie, but she gets in the door. She's a very impressive person. She's very has a dynamic personality. And she's telling Harry that she wants to help. He asks, well, do you have a business card? And she takes out her business card, and it turns out that she runs the Institute for Psychical and Paranormal Research. So he says, geez, you're a psychic. She says, yes, I am, and I'm going to help you figure out what's going on. And he said, well, you know, why is the MBTA sending me a psychic? And it turns out that they didn't really, but she's in the door. And she has a personal interest in this. As we discover later on, before she had the calling to become a psychic, she was an educated person, and she was running a daycare center. And she was managing an outing with her little ones, her little charges, and there was an accident. And the little kids were killed, she's been trying to connect with them ever since. And she was hoping and thinking that if she could work through the Red Line, she could be in contact with them again. So she really wants to get involved, but she doesn't want to do this on a crowded train car with dozens of other people around. She wants the car all to herself. So she's trying to organize this with Harry and the MBTA to let her find these spirits by herself on a car, which of course is not going to happen. They're not going to do that. But she keeps coming up and trying to get involved and kind of forcing herself into the picture. She's an interesting person, in my opinion. I made her up, but she believes that she's reincarnated from earlier lives. She'd been a number of hundred years ago an English barmaid and so on. She really loves England, all things about it. She becomes really obsessed with this. She believes that she's received messages from spirit telling her to don't let the MBTA shut this down. You've got to force them to keep it open. So she tries to get Harry to stop doing what he's doing, and she's very, very angry that he's going to persist with it and allow the MBTA to turn off whatever is causing these visitations to occur. And she keeps in the picture when they move on to create the visitation room. She hears about this, and one of her nephews, an engineer on the MBTA, she gets him involved with the visitation room group that's doing the research, and sort of has a spy in the middle of the process reporting back to her what they're doing and how they're doing it. And that's how she keeps herself apprised of what they're trying to do.
She's an interesting character, because when she's first presented in the book, I think that, and I'm not trying to say that her description is indicative of all psychics. I'm not making a blanket condemnation of all psychics, but she's portrayed as initially kind of a buffoon, you know, somebody that is trying to sort of ingrate themselves and is maybe a little bit unbalanced. But as the story evolves, the reader's perception of that individual changes. Did you, Peter, did I read correctly? Was this something intentional on your part? Is there a cliffhanger towards the end of the book where Dr. Gormelaine is talking with the children in a visitation room experience, and she mentions something about bringing a lifeline of some sort? Is she thinking about trying to somehow experience the children again and come up with some vehicle that she can take them with her when she leaves the visitation room?
They say it has been said that a book is the product of the writer and the reader. It's not just the writer, but also the reader that creates a book, a novel. And so I didn't. If that's in there, I don't recall putting that there. It might be read into it. I the way I see Dr. Gormelaine, she really wants to have the experience with these children, and up to date, she's had intimations and so on, but she doesn't really have the full experience of being visited with them by them. And she's heard about the Red Line, and she wants to do more. She wants to have more of an experience, which she's heard about other people having with their loved ones. So I think that's the core of her motivation. She's also a businesswoman, and she wants to get a piece of whatever the revenues are going to be from the visitation room. But I think her first interest really is to have this experience and to make sure she gets involved enough with it that she has it. And that's in a way, she's a very colorful person. And I think one of the things, the way the book took shape was step by step. You're getting to a point where you think, okay, what happened here? What's the likely next course? What makes sense? And solving each problem as it comes. And I think maybe when I started with Dr. Gormelaine, I wasn't really sure where it was going to go with her. But she grew on the story. She grew on me, and she grew on the story. Matter of fact, she's the main protagonist of the book which I'm writing now, called Portrait of Ignatius Jones. So I like her company, and I'm trying to do more stuff with her.
Mm-hmm.
But she's, it turns out, and I don't want to give away the story here, but it turns out she actually has something which Harry and Alexandra, who are trying to develop a visitation room, she has something that they need very badly. And so in the end, although initially they regard her as a pest and a threat,
right?
They turn to her, and she becomes helpful to them, very, very helpful to them.
Well, here's the passage that I found, and I could have read too much in, but she's in the visitation room, and the child Ming Mai,
yeah,
says, "Is it time for a walk?" Ming Mai asked. "I'll take you for our walk when I return," Dr. Gormelaine said. "I'll bring the rope that we all hold on to stay safe." And so that made me think about, was Dr. Gormelaine trying to figure out how to prolong the experience in the visitation room so that when the light blinked saying that your session's over, and that which produced the experience ceased, and the children would vanish, theoretically, was she thinking about something that maybe would be some sort of a tether or a rope so indeed the kids wouldn't vanish?
Yeah, that's great. That's terrific, and I think that's an example of what the story is a product of both the reader and
just,
the writer.
Just give me a couple percent of the royalties in the future with the sequel, okay?
Okay. What I was thinking about as the writer, I don't know if you've seen this, but I have, and I live in this town near Boston called Lexington. The daycare centers are near town, and when the the people who are minding the children take them out on outings out of the daycare center, they all hold onto a rope. And that's how they make sure they're not tied to the rope, but they're all holding the rope. And that's what they're told to do. They're little tiny things. And that's how they walk along the sidewalk. And when they cross the street, they're all holding on the rope. So that, you know, nobody lets go of the rope, so they all stay together. So that's the image I had in mind.
But. Our guest is Peter David Shapiro. His website is his first name, Peter, the initial D as in David, and last name Shapiro, Shapiro. It's peterdshapiro.com, the author of Ghosts on the Red Line. When a person writes a book, they have maybe a system, maybe a total lack of organization could also be called a system. Can you describe to us how you go about writing? What works for you, David, or Peter, excuse me?
Yeah. I think what works for me best is to try to get through the story as quickly as I can to see if I can get to an ending. So I write it, as I say, each point, you get to a point in the story, you say, what might happen here that makes sense and can be described? And you keep plowing ahead to get to the end, and then you know, at least I know I've got an ending. I've actually told a story that is a real story. And then I go back and fill it in and try to improve it. So it's get the first draft down and then edit it relentlessly. So many, many, many edits and changes. So that was my system. With Ghost in the Red Line, it actually, as I mentioned at the beginning, it moved pretty quickly because things just came to me about what might happen, on the trains. What kind of visitations might occur? How could it occur that it be explained so that if someone believed it was hallucinatory and not really ghosts, how could that be the case? We have explanations for that. And then what would tilt the scale in the other way? And I actually have something in there which is a bit subtle, which for someone who believes that what people are experiencing were really ghosts. There's some evidence for that, and so it's try to keep some suspense going, but figure out what would occur at each stage. When the gangster found out that now that the Red Line was shutting down, they're going to be opening up visitation rooms, what would he do with his hoodlums that he has working for him to stop it? And how would the folks who are building the visitation room, who are just normal civilians and not used to dealing with gangsters, how would they respond? So that's, step by step to get to the end. And when you get to the end, figure, okay, now I have a story, and now I go back and fill it in some more, fill in more color for Dr. Gromelon, for example, more explanation for what she's really up to, what she's like as a person, what her history is.
Peter, do you tend to write at any time, day or night, or do you have a period that really works creatively for you?
I wish I were more organized. I mean, I've read that authors, they lock in 4 hours in the morning, the first thing in the morning or before dawn or nighttime. And I have my little laptop open here all day long, and I just work away at it. I'm easily distracted, unfortunately, very easily distracted. So I do other things, and then I come back to it and sort of fiddle at it. Sometimes I get my best inspiration actually late when I actually should be going to bed. That's when I start to hit on it and I get some stuff done. And then I go back and I revise and keep plowing on. With Ignatius, the portrait of Ignatius Jones, I'm in the stage now of refining. I've got the story down, but it's, it's endless editing.
some writers prefer electronic with a computer or a laptop. Other writers prefer the late and great Robert Ludlum. He used legal pads.
Yeah.
And either pencil or pen.
Yeah, you know, I don't know how they did it. I mean, and Hemingway, of course, he didn't have computers in his day. He was using just a manual computer, a manual typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with my style, it's just a constant revision and refinement and changes. And you can do that on the computer, and to do that with a yellow pad or a manual typewriter, I just don't know how they. I'm sure they were superb writers, and so they. I knew they were superb writers, so maybe they got it mostly right the first time. In my case, it takes a lot of revision.
Well, I'm reminded of the story about J.K. Rowling, who wrote the Harry Potter books. She was on a train trip, and basically had the idea. And sort of sketched out the entire series, and then went back and sort of filled in the gaps.
Right, and that's that is marvelous the way she did that. I wish I could do that. That would be
don't we all?
Right.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. But I start off thinking there's a story here, but I don't know how it's going to end. I don't know how it's going to end until I get to the end.
I could see the book Ghosts on the Red Line being a really interesting film. Have you been approached yet by anybody, or anybody pitched this?
Not yet. I certainly would welcome it. every now and again I try to think of a way to get it in front of Ben Affleck, who does movies about Boston.
Mm-hmm.
But his people haven't called my people, and I don't know who his people are, so I can't call them. But there could be a Boston story in here. I mean, it is. There's a lot that is local about it for Boston, but there's also some universal stuff in it, and I think it would be an interesting film, I think.
Well, if I had a contact for you, I would certainly try to help you. You know, don't try to limit the book to just Boston, because the book could be the springboard for any city in the world that had a subway system on which this could happen with the surrounding environment. I think it would make a great movie. There's some great visuals in there that, as I read the book this week, that I stopped and thought to myself, you know, I could just see this. You've got a crowded subway car, people standing literally so tight together that they can't really lean because they're being supported by the people around them. It's just literally packed like sardines. And all of a sudden somebody, their voices are raised, and people, even in spite of the being packed in there, they sort of shrink back and give this person space. And they're talking to somebody unseen. They're animated. Perhaps even tears, great emotion being exchanged, and nobody else can see what they see.
Right, and that's true. And they also, in many cases, they're on the train for the reason that they want to have visitations from their loved ones, and so they also feel a little envious.
Yes.
Why can't this happen to me? And I'm trying even harder, kind of calling out. So, yeah, I was trying to imagine what would happen, and I think that's one path it could happen, that once the word got out, then the trains would be very crowded with people.
Oh my goodness.
Trying to have their own visitation.
So I wish you well. I hope that this is a fertile, not stopping, but starting point for future books. As you've indicated that you're working on right now, The Portrait of Ignis Jones. And I hope this leads to other things that may include a film project.
Well, thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
Peter, thank you so much for being with us here. And I hope that you have many future great memories of writing. And as I like to say to my writer friends, I hope the muse is always sitting right beside you.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Scott.
Keep up the good work, Peter. Thank you very much for the pleasure I enjoyed by reading the book.
Thank you.
Our guest this morning, Peter David Shapiro, the author of Ghosts on the Red Line. He's also written a book called The Trail of Money, a novel, which is the prequel to Ghosts on the Red Line, and a book to be released sometime next year, Portrait of Igneous Jones. Peter David Shapiro, his website, Peter, the letter D, Shapiro.com. Matt Mundorf, what'd you think?
Very interesting.
I think you're gonna want to either get the or else borrow the book.
Hmm,
I think you'd have a lot of fun with this.
Get a hold of Ben Affleck or Affleck, whatever, and get him to see if he can.
There are people that you know, I think that could do a great job, either a TV series and or the idea of a film project. Because I think, correctly, Peter raises a number of issues. People are interested in what happens when we die. Mm-hmm. Is there something that survives? And or there's always that sense of when somebody passes, sorrow and loss, and if you could just have one more conversation, several more conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was a vehicle that could happen with and be provided for, many people would jump at that chance.
Oh, yeah.
There'd again be opposition from some of the old, entrenched, more fundamentalist religions. Mm. I'm sure of it. But a very interesting concept. So I enjoyed the book. We just have a lot of fun down here. We get to talk with cool people. We get to hang out and drink coffee. I didn't see anything in front of you. Is this part of your training regime now?
I just have one, and that's about it.
So you're doing something tomorrow that you're going to be, is it jogging or just flat out running?
Jogging as much as I can and then walking.
Is there a reason? Like, is somebody chasing you tomorrow? What's going on?
No, just to try and get my butt into shape. So I don't know. Try and get more cardiovascular.
Getting into shape,
exercise.
So you're taking part in a run tomorrow.
Yep, it's.
Can you mention that?
Yeah, it's the beer and bagel run out at Quarry Oaks Golf Course. I think it's 8:30. I have to look at it again. Pretty early. I guess it sounds like it's supposed to also kind of be a mud run as well. So everybody's supposed to bring a change of clothes because you're probably going to get pretty slimy. I just hope I'm warmed up enough that I don't get too muddy and cold.
So, God, that's all I would need. I could, you know, if I start to jog or run, I just perspire like a berserko, and then combine that with dirt or mud. Oh yeah, I would look the part.
Well, you know, everybody's having fun. You know, it's not a, you know, everybody's not wearing their best, you know, suit. It's a fun deal, and then after everybody's done, you have, I guess, bagels and have a couple beers. I guess it'll be a fun time. So yeah, I'm kind of excited for it.
Last week on. Thursday was Halloween.
Yeah.
So did the Mundorfs have a good Halloween?
Yep. We usually hand out candy to all the little kiddies, and we had quite a few. We just under 100 kids we had come to the door.
It's all based upon neighborhood families.
We've got a
percentages.
Lot of young families.
In the near south neighborhood, I had zero.
Really?
Yeah. And I had stopped off to make sure that I did have ample amounts of candy at the grocery store early evening on Thursday evening.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a guy that walked up into the candy aisle at the grocery store, and he had this sort of wild-eyed look, and he looked at me and he said, "I see you've run out too." So he had come back to the store because they'd already had trick-or-treaters. He had run out, and he was re-upping his supply then.
Yep, I've done
and he
that.
Was grabbing bags there and throwing to the cart. But so the Colborns have plenty of Snicker bars and Three Musketeer bars left over.
We went overboard on grabbing candy, so we've got a lot of extra, but having three teenagers, they'll probably be gone by next week.
So Halloween is supposed to be, allegedly, through folklore and legend, the time of the year that the veil is the thinnest.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll wait and see if people come forward with reports of activity. You know, the paranormal, again, is that big, broad term that covers so many different subcategories. Mm-hmm. It could cover, you know, UFO sightings, ghosts and apparitions and hauntings and all sorts of other interesting phenomena. So
that'd be something fun maybe next year to do a show on the history of you know, maybe get an author to call in and talk about the different historical stories of Halloween. That would be fun.
Well, I'll give you a compliment again about the Nebraska Ghost Series. You know, we hear back quite frequently from people saying that they enjoy those shows.
Yep.
And there's a number of our fans, Matt, and I think they're more than just you, that really like the shows that have to do with ghosts and hauntings and things. And so there's a solid core out there that we're trying to help. And Matt, of course, as many of you know, has been in contact with a number of groups around, and we've tried to arrange shows. What about the group Prism? Have you ever heard back from them?
I'd have to check with them again out of Omaha.
They recently sent me a Facebook friendship thing. So,
Well, maybe they. I know a lot of these groups are pretty packed. You know, they get pretty busy, and it, you know, it's something that they we can't deal with it for a while.
Some groups, of course, need to just check their email too.
Yeah, that as well.
You could very well have already.
I've met them and they're really nice. If we can, if we can get the schedules to combine, that would be, I think they would be a fun group to either have on the phone or have them pop down from Omaha, whatever's easiest.
We do have more of the Nebraska Ghost Series happening all throughout the rest of this year and into 2014. If you'd like to find out more about our guest list that Matt and I have coming up, you can find us on Facebook, Exploring Unexplained Phenomena, and we'd love to have you friend us. And it's very easy. There's a little tab that says Files. You can click on that, and you can see all the upcoming guests, their contact information. Speaking of which, next week is Mystic Pete and Mystic Pete Chronicles, Book 1, Sex, and Mysticism. I'll take seconds, please.
Yeah. You know,
2 weeks from today is Tanis Helliwell. I spoke earlier of her. Mm-hmm. She'll be talking about her book, Pilgrimage with the Leprechauns.
Ooh.
A true story of a mystical tour of Ireland.
Mm. Very cool.
And again, folks, if you believe in fairies and elves, they are real.
I'd love to see them.
Remember what Peter Pan said? Peter Pan said, I believe. November 23rd, Dr. Joe Gallenberger. This will be very interesting. He's taken some modern research into consciousness, brain, and cognition, and he's written a book called Inner Vagus, Creating Miracles, Abundance, and Health. And he takes groups of people into places like casinos. Mm-hmm. And takes these principles and shows them how they can literally win. So
I could use that.
No kidding. We've got a great schedule coming up, folks. We hope you'll stay tuned for us and with us. In walks our station manager, Kathy Burns. Mm-hmm. Kathy, do you want to say anything to anybody out there?
Just say hi to Jim. It's okay.
Can we talk about that?
Just tell him hi.
Okay, Jim Anderson, you big lug. Hello from all of us here at KZUM. And Jim, we love you. And Jim, you still owe me $5. All the best to Jim Anderson. Keep those prayers going for Jim. And it's great to hear the updates on Jim Anderson. So God bless you, Jim, if you're listening. And if you're not, why aren't you? No, he's a longtime friend.
Yeah.
He and I can kid back and forth, and he and I both know where the bodies are buried, so we have mutually assured destruction. great stuff coming up, folks, on Exploring Unexplained Phenomena. Also great things here on KZWM. We've got New Dimensions in about 60 seconds. And we've got more great programming, Religion for Life at 1 o'clock. Matt and I will be back next week. Happy November, everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And Fox Craig here. Colborn, my brother Craig, November 5th, Mr. Craig Colborn. Happy birthday, youngster. Matt, we'll see you next week.
See ya.
Deal?
I will be there.
Deal.
An hour fall back.
I'm Scott Colborne. Until next week, walk in beauty.